This is Thelma English, and I'm going to be reading to you from Virgil's Aeneid, Book 8. We're using the Robert Fitzgerald translation. You need to have your book by your side as we read this. At the end of Book 7, I told you you didn't have to listen to the audio of all of the lists of soldiers and commanders, but it does appear that at line 1105, in Book 7, they mention Camilla of the Volscian people. You can turn a page back and take a look at that real quick. She has the skills of Minerva, but Camilla is a warrior woman, and it's important for us to remember that Camilla is also here for part of the battle. All right, Book 8. That day, when Turnus raised the flag of war over Laurentum Tower, and his trumpets blared hoarse-throated, when he laid the whip on fiery teams, making bright armor clang, then hearts were stirred by fear, then all of Latium joined in distracted tumult, and young men grew bloody-minded and wild. The high commanders, Messapus and Ufens, and that one who held the gods in scorn, Mezentius, from every quarter drew repeated levies, and laid the wide fields waste of their field hands. Dispatched to Diomedes' distant cry, Villainous went to ask for aid. So they even go and send and ask for help from Diomedes, to state that Trojans had a foothold in Latium, that landing there Aeneas had brought in his conquered gods, and claimed to be a king called for by destiny, that many tribes made league with the Dardanian, and his name reverberated far and wide through Latium. What he might build on his first enterprise, what he desired as outcome of the war, should fortune favor him, that would be clearer to Diomedes than to either king, Turnus or Latinus. Thus affairs took shape in Latium, and Laomedon's heir, that's Aeneas, who saw the whole scene, weltered in his trouble, wave after wave of it. This way and that he led his mind run, passing quickly over all that he might do, and when the basin's full of unstilled water, struck by a ray of sun, or the bright disk of moon, a flickering light, plays over water and corners and flies up. So this is another simile. So he's letting his mind try to figure out what he should do. And what's it like? It's like when basins full of water, they get struck by a ray of sun or by the bright disk of the moon, and a flickering light plays over walls and corners and flies up to hit high roof beams on a coffered ceiling. Now it was night. And through the lands of earth, deep slumber held all weary living things of bird and beast kind, when the Trojan prince Aeneas, heartsick at the woe of war, lay down upon the riverside in the cold air under the open sky and gave his body at last last repose. Before him, as he slept, the very god of that place, Tiburnius of fair waters. So this is the god of the river Tiber. Lifting his hoary head through poplar leaves, appeared all veiled in cobweb glory, of great and crowned with shady sedge. So he's probably the river god of Tiberius is appearing to him perhaps in a dream. He seemed to speak in these words to relieve the burdened man. Sir, born of heaven, in whose care Troy city now comes back to us from its enemies, and in whose keeping high and everlasting Pergama stands, you whom Laurentine soil and Latin countryside have long awaited, here is your home, your hearth gods fixed and sure. Now it is no time to go or give way to fear at threats of war. Angers that rose among the gods have passed, and I can tell you, lest you suppose this nothing but a dream, under the shoreside oaks a giant sow, a pig, will be discovered lying on the ground with her new pharaoh, 30 young all told. So he's going to find a pig with 30 little piglets, 30 young all told, a white sow with white suckling at her teats. And by this portent, after 30 years, Ascanius will found the famous town called Alba, or White City. I foretell no doubtful matter, but just now, as to what lies ahead and how you may win through it, listen, and I'll explain in a few words. In this country, an Arcadian tribe, descended from a forebear called Pallas, colonists with King Evander, followers of his flag, marked out a spot, and founded on the hills a town they named for Pallas, Pelentium, always at war with Latins as they are. Join forces with them, make them your allies. I myself, between my banks, will take you straight upstream, so you'll make way with oars against the current. Son of Venus, rise. Aeneas, get up. Now, while the early stars of evening set, address your prayers in proper form to Juno. Melt with your pleas her menaces and anger. You'll make return to me when you prevail. So go make your peace with Juno, because she's the one who hates you. I am that river in full flood you see cutting through farmland, gliding past these banks, the sea-blue Tiber, heaven-delighting stream. My mansion's here, my fountainhead far north, amid the hilltop cities. Having spoken, he sank away into the watery depths at the river bottom. From Aeneas, then, night-time and sleep departed, and he rose. Facing the light that fanned up against the east from the pure sun, he cupped his ritual hands to lift clear water from the stream, then spoke his heartfelt prayer to heaven. Nymphs of the springs, Laurentine nymphs, mothers of river kind and Father Tiber, with your sacred stream, take in Aeneas as your guest. At last shield him from peril. By whatever source the ponds lie that embrace you in your pity for our ill fortune, from whatever ground you well up in your loveliness, you'll be forever honored and adored forever with gifts from me, O potent stream, great lord of waters in the west. Only be with me and give me confirmation of your will. He finished. So he's very pious. He finished, then selected from his squadron two biremes, and then manned and armed, but something suddenly caught his eye. A sign to, so he, two biremes, they're boats, a sign to marvel at. Snow white in the green wood, snow white as her own litter, lay the sow upon the grassy bank, where all could see, and grave Aeneas dedicated her to thee, Juno the Great, to thee indeed, lifting both sow and brood before the altar in sacrifice. So he sees the sign, and he got the confirmation he asked for, and he sacrifices all 31 pigs to Juno. Then all that night's long hours the Tiber quieted his swollen stream, encountering his current with still water, slackened so that like a tranquil pool or placid marsh, he smoothed his whole expanse and left no toil for oars. So once he put his boat in, there wasn't even any current. He just can go upstream without any difficulty. Once underway, therefore, cheered on, they made good speed upstream. Their tarry hulls, with bubbling wakes behind, slipped to the water, and the waves were awed. The virgin woods were awed at this new sight. The soldiers' shields that flashed in distant air, the painted ships afloat upon the river, oarsmen out wearied night and day in rowing, past the long bends shaded by differing trees, and cleft green forests in the mirroring water. At that hour, when the fiery sun had climbed to heaven's midpoint, distant still they saw wall, citadel, a few housetops, the town built heavenward by Roman power, now but meager then and poor, held by Evander. In toward the settlement they swung their prows. By chance that day the Arcadian king paid honor to Heracles, great son of Amphitron, and to the other gods in festival outside the town in a green grove. With him were his son Pallas and his leading men and homespun senate. I have to tell you that Pallas, the son of the king, is going to turn out to be Aeneas's best friend, and this is a big deal. They made offerings of incense while hot blood fumed on the altars. When they caught sight of the tall ships and saw the strangers gliding through the woodland shade, rowing in silence, they were caught by fear at the sudden apparition, and all sprang up, leaving the feast. But Pallas, with high heart, forbade them to disrupt the ritual. Taking a spear, he ran toward the newcomers and called out, while still distant from a mound, "Soldiers, what brought you this strange way? Where bound? What is your nation? Where is your home?" he said. "Do you bring peace or war?" Then Lord Aeneas, from his high poop, called back as he held out a branch of olive, signifying peace. "You see before your eyes men born in Troy, enemy lances to the Latins, those who arrogantly attacked us in our exile. We come to find Evander. Take this message. Say chosen captains of Dardania have come proposing partnership in war." Struck by that faraway great name, young Pallas called, "Disembark, whoever you may be, and speak directly to my father. Come, you'll be the guest of our hearth gods tonight." He took Aeneas's hand in a strong grip, and up the grove they went, leaving the river. Then for the king Aeneas had friendly words. "Most noble son of Greece, fortune would have me make my appeal to you with suppliant bows." Line 175. "I have not feared you as Arcadian, or captain of Danans, or bloodkin of the Atreidae. No, my own manhood and heaven's holy words, our ancestry in common and your fame through all the world, have brought me here by destiny, and gladly to join my strength with yours. The Greeks maintain Electra bore the founding father of Troy, old Dardanus, who sailed to the Teucrians. Electra was the child of that prodigious Atlas, who upholds the heavenly sphere on a snowy shoulder. Father of your line was Mercury, whom snow-white Maia bore on the cold summit of Cyllene. Maia fathered, if we can trust these tales, by the same Atlas, pillar of starry sky. So both our lines are branches of one blood. Putting my trust in this, I sent no legates, made no roundabout approaches to you, but have exposed myself and my own life in coming as a suppliant." The Donanians, the race that harries you, now harries us in savage war. So our own enemies, they're your enemies too. If they defeat and rout us, nothing, so they believe, stands in the way of their subduing all Hesperia, all Italy, ruling the seas that bathe her north and south. Trust as we trust you. We have the stamina for warfare, and we have the spirit for it. In difficulties, our men have proved themselves. Here Aeneas paused. For all this time, Evander's glaze had slowly swept the speaker, his eyes, his countenance, and his whole figure. Now he replied, "Most gallant Teucrian, how happily I welcome you and know you. How you remind me of your father's speech, the great voice of Anchises, and his look." So he knows Aeneas' father, and Aeneas looks just like his dad. "For I remember how Prince Priam, son of old Laomedon, Salamis bound to the kingdom of Hesione, his sister, visited the cold Arcadian land. The bloom of youth was on me. I admired the Trojan leaders and admired Priam, but tallest in that company by far your father passed. With a boy's adoration, I longed to speak to him, to shake his hand, so I approached. Then all aglow, I led him into Phineus' town. His parting gifts were a quiver full of fine arrows, Lycian arrows, a gold brocaded cloak, and two gold bits, those that my palace owns now." So he gave them to his son. "Well then, here is what you ask. My right hand in a pact, and when first light returns to earth tomorrow, I'll send you back with a fresh increment of troops to gladden you, and fresh supplies. Now, since you come as friends, be kind enough to join us at our feast, one held each year and not to be postponed. Become acquainted, even so soon, with how your allies fare." On this he called for dishes and wine cups already taken off to be brought back, as he himself gave the guests grassy seats and led Aeneas to the place of honor, a maple chair cushioned with lionskin. Then picked men and the priest who served the altar vied with one another to bring roast meat, to lead bread baskets with the gifts of Ceres, milled and baked, and pour out wine. Aeneas with his Trojans feasted then on a brief chine and flesh of sacrifice. When they were fed, their appetites appeased, royal Evander spoke. "No empty-headed superstition, blind to the age-old gods, imposed this ritual on us, and this feast, this altar to a divine force of will. No, Trojan guest, we carry out these rites, renewed each year, as men saved from a barbaric danger in the past. Look first of all at this high, overhanging rocky cliff. See how rock masses have been scattered out, leaving a mountain dwelling there, forsaken where the crags fell in avalanche. Here was once a cave, with depths no ray of sun could reach. When Caucus lived, a bestial form, half man, and the ground reeked forever with fresh blood, while nailed up in vile pride on his cave doors were men's pale, fastly faces ghastly in decay. So they used to have a monster who lived there and would grab people and nail them up on his door. Vulcan, Hephaestus, had fathered this unholy brute, who, as he moved about in mammoth bulk, belched out the poisonous fires of the father. So this annual festival is celebrating Heracles, who killed the Vulcan's beast son, Cacus, this evil thing, this bestial form. After long prayers, time brought even to us a god's advent and aid. The great avenger, Heracles, appeared. I think it's funny they call him the great avenger here, not knowing what 2021 would bring in television movies. The great avenger, Heracles, appeared, still flushed with pride in spoils he took when slaughtering Garen, the triple-bodied giant. And as conqueror, he drove the giant bulls this way before him, while the mild herds grazed in our river valley. Cacus's bloodthirsty mind, madly aroused to leave no crookedness untried, no crime unventured, turned four bulls out of their grounds, four heifers too, all of the handsomest, but not to leave their hoof tracks going away. He held their tails and pulled the cattle backward, traces of passage thus reversed, and hid the stolen beasts in the cave's rocky darkness. Caveward then, no sign would leave a searcher. Now when Amphitron's heroic son had got his well-fed cattle on the move out of their pasture, ready to depart, the oxen bellowed at this leave-taking, filling the wood with protest, crying loud to the hills they left. One answer came, one heifer out of the cave depth lowed out of her prison, foiling Cacus's hope. For now indeed the affront of it, said Heracles, ablaze with black bile of anger. Taking arms, taking in hand his knotted massy club, he ran for the mountaintop. Our people then saw for the first time fear in Cacus's eyes, as faster than the east wind he made off to reach his cave, and terror winged his feet. He shut himself inside, breaking the chain whereat where wrought there in iron by his father's hand to keep a boulder dangling. Down it crashed to block the entrance. None too soon. Imagine Heracles of Tyrannies in his fury facing that wall. This way and that he turned and stared to measure every access point and ground his teeth, and in his rage 3 times went over all Mount Aventine, 3 times in vain pitted himself against the rock and rested 3 times wearied in the valley. But from the ridge over the cave arose a flinty pinnacle sheer on all sides, a towering home for nests of carrion birds. As to the left, this leaned over the river. The hero strained against it from the right and shook it till the rock-embedded roots were loosened, then torn free, and all at once he heaved it over. At that fall, great heaven thundered. River margins leapt apart, and the shocked stream in flood surged backward. Then the cavern, Cacus's huge domain, unroofed, lay open to its gloomy depth, as though earth by some force cracked open in its depth, unlocked the underworld, and brought to view the ghastly realm the gods hate, the abyss now visible from above, and ghosts a-tremble in the daylight let in. Caught by the light unlooked for and closed in by stone, the giant bellowed as never in his life before, whilst from above with missiles Hercules let fly at him, calling on every mass at hand to make a weapon, raining down dry boughs and boulders like millstones. But then the monster, seeing no escape was left, wonderful to relate, belched from his gullet clouds of smoke, blanketing all the place in blinding haze that took sight from the eyes and thickened in the cave to smoky night, profound gloom laced with fire. Hercules' great heart could not abide this trick, but down he plunged, headlong in one leap through the flames where the smoke bellowed thickest and the cavern seethed in that black cloud. Down there he caught and pinioned Cacus as the monster belched his fires in vain. Fastening on his throat, he choked him till his eyes burst out, his gullet whitened and his dried up with loss of blood. Soon the black den was cleared, the doors torn off, the stolen cattle, loot their tracks denied, revealed in the light of day, and the misshapen carcass dragged out by the heels. Our people could not be sated by the spectacle, but gazed long at the dreadful eyes, the face, the shaggy, bristling chest of the half-beast, his gorgeous, fiery breath put out. Since then, this feast is held, and younger men are glad to keep the memory of that day. In chief, Putidius, the founder, and the house of the Pinari, custodians of rites to Heracles. Here in the grove he placed his altar, ever to be called the greatest by ourselves, and be the greatest. Come then, soldiers, honor that great feat. Garland your head with leaves. Hold out your cups, invoke the god we share, and tip your wine most heartily. So come, cheer with us. At this, with poplar leaves of shifting color, Herculean shade, he veiled his hair, and the leafy braided wreath hung down at the blessed wine cup filled his hand. Tipping their wine at once over the table, the others made their prayer. So they're making an offering. Meanwhile, Olympian heaven downward turned. Evening came on, and soon the priests, led by Potitius, after their ancient mode, belted in furs, went round with torches. They renewed the feast, bringing a welcome second course, and heaped the altar tops with dishes. For a hymn at the lit altars came the Salii, all garlanded with poplar files of dancers, here of the young, there of the elder men, who praised in song the feat of Heracles, his story, how he grappled monsters first, choking his stepmother's twin snake, and how again by might he ruined tall towns in war, Troy town, and then Achaia, and endured 1,000 bitter toils under Eurystheus, his 12 labors, doomed to these by Juno's enmity. O thou unconquered one, who slew the centaurs, Pholus and Helios, born of cloud, and broke the terror of Crete by thy right hand, and killed the lion under Nemea's crag. Before thee shook the Stygian lates, the keeper of Orcus shook, sprawled in his gory cave, on bones partly devoured. No monstrous form affrighted thee, even Typhius' self, through mountainous in arms, and Lerna's Hydra, coiling about thee, with a swarm of heads, attacked no guileless warrior. Hail to thee, true son of Jove, and they mean Heracles, new glory of the gods, because Heracleos means glory of Hera, and so that's kind of a play on his name. True son of Jove, new glory of the gods, with friendly stride, come join us, join thy feast. So rang the hymns they sang, and crowning all a song of Cacus's crave, cave and breath of fire, voices that filled the leafy wood and rang and sprang back from the echoing hillsides. When they had carried out the ritual, they turned back to the town, and, slowed by age, the king walked, keeping Aeneas and his son close by his side, with talk of various things to make the long path easy. Marveling, Aeneas gladly looked at all about him, delighted with the setting, asking questions, hearing of earlier men and what they left. Then King Evander, founder unaware of Rome's great citadel, said, "These woodland places once were homes of local fauns and nymphs, together with a race of men that came from tree trunks, from hard oak. They had no way of settled life, no arts of life, no skill at yoking oxen, gathering provisions, practicing husbandry, but got their food from oaken boughs and wild game hunted down. In that first time out of Olympian heaven, Saturn came here in flight from Jove in arms, an exile from a kingdom lost. He brought these unschooled men together from the hills where they were scattered, gave them laws, and chose the name of Latium from his latency of safe concealment in his countryside. In his reign were the golden centuries, men tell of still, so peacefully he ruled, till gradually a meaner, tarnished age came on with fever of war and lust of gain. Then came Ausonians and Sicanians, and Saturn's land now often changed her name, and there were kings, one savage and gigantic, Thybris, from whom we afterborn Italians named the river Tiber." So King Thybris is the river Tiber. The old name was Abula. Named the Tiber. The old name, Abula, was lost. Albua. "As for myself, in exile from my country, I set out for the sea's end, but fortune that prevails in everything, fate not to be thrown off, arrested me in this land. Solemn warnings came from my mother, from the nymph Carmentis, backed by the god Apollo to urge me here. Just after this, as he went on, he showed the altar and the gate to the Romans called Carmental, honoring as of old the nymph and prophetess Carmentis, first to sing the glory of Pelentium and Aeneas's great ascendants. Descendants. Then he showed the wood that Romulus would make a place of refuge. Then the grotto called the Lupercal." Now this Lupercal is the grotto. It's a cave of Faunus, and it's at the foot of the Palatine Hill. And they believed that that was the home of the wolf. Luper is the Latin word for wolf. And that's where they thought that the Lupercal, the she-wolf, nourished and suckled Romulus and Remus when they were thrown into the basket and washed up on the Tiber, and then the she-wolf took them into this grotto. And it was the Lupercal festival, when you read Antony and Cleopatra, that was going on right at the beginning. "Then the grotto called the Lupercal under the cold crag, named in Arcadian fashion after Lycian Pan, and then as well he showed the sacred wood of Argilitum, Argus's death, and took oath by it, telling of a guest Argus put to death. From there he led to our Tarpeian site and capital, all golden now in those days, tangled, wild with underbrush, but awesome even then." So this is Virgil stepping right out. He's talking to his audience and saying, well, it's all golden now, but in those days it was all tangled, wild with underbrush, but awesome even then. A strangeness there filled country hearts with dread and made them shiver at the wood and rock. "Some god," he said, "it is not sure what god, lives in this grove, this hilltop thick with leaves. Arcadians think they've seen great Jove himself, sometimes with his right hand shaking the Aegis to darken sky and make the storm clouds rise, towering in turmoil." So we don't know, you know, we don't even know what god lives up here, maybe even Jove. And of course, on the Capitol, their Tarpeian site in the Capitol Hill is where they did have a temple to Jove. And so he's going in back history 1,000 years and saying, we don't know, there were these leaves that did weird things. It was almost like Jove shaking the Aegis. Well, for all we know, god lives here. "Here too, in these walls, long fallen down, you see what were two towns, monuments of the ancients. Father Janus founded one stronghold, Saturn the other, named Janiculum and Saturnia. Conversing of such matters, going toward austere Evander's house, they saw his cattle lowing everywhere in what is now Rome's Forum and her fashionable quarter." Here is Virgil again speaking to the Romans themselves 1,000 years later. Carinae, as they came up to the door, Evander said, "In victory, Heracles bent for this lintel, and these royal rooms were grand enough for him. Friend, have the courage to care little for wealth, and shape yourself, you too, into merit godhead. Do not come disdainfully into our needy home." Even as he spoke, he led under the gabled, narrow roof Aeneas's mighty figure, and made him rest where on strewn leaves he spread a Libyan bearskin. Swiftly night came on to fold her dusky wings about the earth. Line 491. Now Venus, as a mother sorely frightened, and with good reason, moved by the menaces of the Laurentines and their hostile rising, so Venus, Aphrodite, is very worried about her son Aeneas, turned to Vulcan, Hephaestus, in her bridal chamber, all of gold, putting divine desire in every word she said, "While Argive kings lay their due victim, Pergama waste, her towers doomed to fall in fires, her enemies set, never did I demand for the desperate any relief at all, no weapons forged by your skill in your metal. Most dear husband, I never wished to tax you, to make you toil in a lost cause, however much I owed to Priam's sons, however long I wept over Aeneas's ordeals. Now, however, by the command of Jove, he has made good his landing on the Rutulian shore, and so I do come now, begging your sacred power for arms, a mother begging for her son, the daughter of Nereus moved you." So she's talking about Thetis. Thetis was a daughter of Nereus, and Thetis married Peleus, and they had Achilles, and Thetis would bring Achilles' armor. So she's asking, the daughter of Nereus, Thetis, moved you, and Tithonus' consort moved you by her tears to this. Look now and see what masses throng together. See what cities lock their gates and whet the sword against me to cut down my own. The goddess spoke and wrapped her snowy arms this way and that about him as he lingered, cherishing him in her swan's down embrace. And instantly he felt the flame of love invading him as ever. Into his marrow ran the fire he knew, and through his bones, as when sometimes. So what was it like when she wraps her arms around him and says, "Oh, honey, I need some armor for Aeneas. Oh, I love you so much." As when sometimes, ripped by a thunder peal, a fiery flash goes jagged through the clouds, his wife, contented with her blandishment, sure of her loveliness, perceived it all. Lord Vulcan, Hephaestus, captive to immortal passion, answered her, "Why do you go so far afield for reasons? Has your trust in me gone elsewhere, goddess? If concern like this had moved you in the old days, even then I might have armed the Trojans lawfully, for neither Jove almighty nor the fates forbade Troy to endure, Priam to live 10 further years. If you are ready now to arm for war and have a mind to wage it, all the devoted craft that I can promise, all that is forgeable in steel and molten alloy by the strength of a blast fire, you need not beg me for these gifts. Have done with doubting your own powers. He said no more, but took her in his arms as she desired and gave himself, infused in her embrace, to peace and slumber. When his first repose came to an end in the mid-course of night, now on the wane, and waked him, at that hour when a poor woman whose hard lot it is to make living by her loom and spindle, pokes up the embers, wakes the sleeping fire, adding some night time to her morning's work, and by the firelight keeps her household maids employed in their long task, all to keep chaste her marriage bed and bring her children up. At that same hour, no more slothful than she, the Lord of Fire, rose from his soft bed to labor at the smithy. So just like, so Hephaestus got up, Vulcan, or as we've known him, Hephi, gets up in the middle of the night to start working, to work on this armor, just like an old woman would do if she had to do a lot of weaving, you know, to support her family. Near the coast of Sicily and Aeolian Lipari, a steep island arises, all of rock and smoking. This is Mount Etna in Sicily, and remember that Vulcan Hephaestus' forge is under Mount Etna, and so when it's thundering and stuff, they think he's forging, doing work in his forge. So near the coast of Sicily and Aeolian Lipari, a steep island rises, all of rock and smoking. Underneath, a mammoth cave and vaulted galleries of Etna, burned away by blast fire from the Cyclops' forge, rumble in thunder. Mighty blows are heard, re-echoing and booming from the anvils. Chalcedon bars of iron hiss in the caverns. Vulcan's workshop, named for him Vulcania. To this the Lord of Fire came down from heaven, working with iron in the enormous cave, where were Cyclops, Thunderclap, and Anvil Fire, and Flash, stripped to the waist. Oh, and here we have a Cyclops named Flash. They had a bolt in hand, such as from open sky the father often hurls to earth. This one part done, parts still unfinished. So they're working on a thunderbolt for Zeus. First the smiths had added twisted hail, three rays of rain cloud, three of red fire, and the flying south wind. Now they were mixing in terrifying lightning, fracas and fear and anger in pursuit with flares. Elsewhere they strove to finish a chariot of Mars and flying wheels of which he might stir fighting men and cities. Then to an Aegis, a cuirass bringing dread of Pallas when aroused. They gave a polish, vying to shine the golden serpent scales, the knot of vipers and the gorgon's head, for the goddess's very breast, with severed neck and rolling eyes. Put all these things away, commanded Vulcan. In other words, stop what you're doing. We're going to make armor for Aeneas. Put all these things away, commanded Vulcan. Cyclops under Aetna, drop the work began. Here is our task. Armor is to be forged for a brave soldier. Now we can use your brawn and your deft hands, your craft, your mastery. Shake off all reluctance. Vulcan, Hephi said no more, but they, for their part, buckled down as one, allotting equal tasks to each. In streams the molten brass and gold flowed. Iron that kills turned liquid in the enormous furnace heat. They shaped a vast shield, one that might alone be proof against all missiles of the Latins, fastened it layer on layer, sevenfold. Some smiths drew pulsing in and blasted out the air with bellows. Others plunged the metal, screeching in fresh water, and the cavern groaned under the anvils they set down. Now this, now that one, for a mighty stroke, brought up his arms in rhythm as they hammered, shifting the metal mass with gripping tongs. While in Aeolia, this is the home of the winds, the Lipari, they have an island north of Sicily. So Aeolia is island of the winds. While in Aeolia, Vulcan, lord of Lemnos, pressed that fiery task, mild morning light with bird song under eaves awoke Evander. And the old man rose. He slipped his arms into his tunic and bound it on his trim Tyrrhenian sandals. Then by shoulder and flank slung his Arcadian blade, a mantle hide of panther where it hung down on the left. He tossed back. Then his two awakened watchdogs preceded him out of the entranceway and kept close to their master. He went on to visit the secluded place his guest, Aeneas, occupied, and he remembered what had been said, what favors he had promised. Just as early, Aeneas had come outside, and one man had his son beside him, Pallas. The other had a cat, Achates. When they met, they joined hands and sat down in the open court to talk, enjoy the talk at last permitted them. The king began, saying, "Greatest of Trojan captains," that's Aeneas, "never while you live shall I consider Troy to be conquered and her kingdom gone. But though our name is great, our power is slight to strengthen you in war. We are confined on this side by the river, and on that the Rutulians bring pressure on our wall with noisy forays. No, I plan for you a league with a great host, an army rich in many kingdoms. Here, by unforeseen good fortune, your salvation now appears. Fate called for your coming. No long way from here, men live in the city of Agila, built of ancient stone. The Lydians, renowned in war, in the old days settled there on the Etruscan ridges, and for years the city flourished, till an arrogant king, Mezentius, ruled it barbarously by force. How shall I tell of carnage beyond telling, beastly crimes this tyrant carried out? Requite them, gods, on his own head and on his children. He would even couple carcasses with living bodies as a form of torture." So this wicked king, Mezentius, even tied people to dead bodies. "Hand to hand and face to face, he made them suffer corruption, oozing gore and slime in that wretched embrace and a slow death. But at long last, the townsmen, sickening of his unholy ways, took arms and laid siege to the madman and his house. They killed his henchmen and threw fire on his roof. But in the midst of slaughter, he escaped, took refuge in Rutilian country, and got himself defended by the arms of Turnus, host and friend. On this account, Etruria's people have risen as one man in righteous anger, threatening war at once, demanding the king back for punishment. Now I will make you leader of these thousands, Aeneas, for in fact, while ships of theirs are crowded on the shore and fret for action, calling for ensigns to go forward, still a soothsayer of great age holds them all back, forewarning them. So the soothsayer is going to tell them that a stranger has to lead them. Ooh, picked men of Maeonia, flower and heart of an old heroic race, though justly moved by your past suffering against your enemy, and though Mezentius, the exiled Etruscan king, fires you with rightful anger, no Italian may have command of this great people's cause. Choose leaders from abroad." Taking alarm at heaven's warning, the Etruscan ranks rest on their arms here in this plain, and Tarchon sends me envoys with his crown and scepter, badges of regal power. He asks that I go up to camp and take the Tyrrhenian throne, but slow and cold old age, weakened by years, forbids command, and old man's vigor falls behind in action. I should urge my son to accept, if he were not of mingled blood, through a Saban mother, heir to her fatherland. No, you are he whose age and foreign birth the fates approve, and whom the gods desire. Enter on your great duty now, great heart, commander of Trojans and Italians both. I shall, besides, commit to you my palace, his son, all my comfort and my hope, to learn with you as master how to weather battle, Mars' dead serious work. May he become familiar with your actions, look to you as his exemplar from his early years, so you'll be his tutor. I'll add 200 horsemen, all Arcadians, picked for ruggedness. In his own name, Pallas will give 200 more. In silence, line 705, after this speech, Anchises' son Aeneas, and faithful at his side, Achates, sat with downcast eyes. They would have pondered long and grimly on the many trials to come, had not Cytherean queen from open heaven, so that's Venus, Aphrodite going to send a sign to her son Aeneas, had not Cytherean queen from open heaven given a sign, one utterly unforeseen, a quivering flash out of the upper air, a thundercrack, and in that instant all the sky seemed falling, as it seemed on high, a Tyrrhene trumpet gave a rumbling blast. They all looked up. Again and yet again, tremendous crashes came. Between the clouds in sunlit air, they saw red glare of armor clashing, thundering at the shock. The others sat still, mystified, but Troy's great captain, Aeneas, recognized the sound and knew the promise made by his goddess mother. And then he said, "My friend, you need not ask what new events portended. I'm the man whom heaven calls. This sign my goddess mother prophesied she would send if war broke out, and said, too, she would bring out of the sky arms made by Vulcan, Hephi, to assist me. Aye, what carnage is at hand for poor Laurentines. What retribution you will make to me, Turnus. Many a shield, many a helm, and many brave men's bodies you'll take under, Father Tiber. Let them insist on war. Let them break treaties." After saying this, he rose from his high seat, this is Aeneas, and first revived the fires for Heracles on slumbering altars, gladly revisiting, as yesterday, the guardian Lar and humble household gods. Likewise, Evander and the men of Troy made sacrifice of chosen ewes. Thereafter, back to his ships and comrades went Aeneas, and chose among them soldiers known for bravery to follow him to war. The rest were carried effortlessly downstream on the current to bring Ascanius news of these affairs and of his father. Those Etruria bound were now supplied with horses. For Aeneas they led a special mount, all blanketed with a lion skin gleaming with gilded claws. Then suddenly a rumor flew about the little town that horsemen were departing quickly for the Etrurian king's domain. Mothers in fright doubled their prayers. Fear brought danger nearer, and the specter of war grew larger in their eyes. But Lord Evander clung to the hand of his departing son, Pallas, and could not have enough of tears. He said, "If only Jupiter would give me back the past years and the man I was, when I cut down the front rank by Praeneste wall and won the fight and burned the piles of shields I had dispatched to hell with this right-hand King Erulus, to whom Feronia, his mother, gave 3 lives at birth, a thing to chill the blood, 3 sets of arms to fight with, so that he had to be brought down 3 times. Yet this hand took his lives that day, took all, and each time took his arms. I should not now be torn from you, and from your dear embrace, my son, and neither would Mezentius have shown contempt from me, his bordering power, putting so many cruelly to the sword and widowing his town of citizens. But, O high masters, and thou, Jupiter, supreme ruler of gods, pity, I beg, the Arcadian king, and hear a father's prayer. If by thy will my son survives and fate spares him, and if I live to see him still, to meet him again, I pray for life. There is no trouble I cannot endure, but fortune, if you threaten some black day. Now let me break off my bitter life while all's in doubt, while hope of what's to come remains uncertain, while I hold you here, dear boy, my late delight, my only one, and may no graver message ever come to wound my ears." These were the father's words, poured out in a final parting. He collapsed completely, and the servants helped him in. So he wants to live if his son's going to come back alive, and he wants to just die now if he's not. And now, indeed, through the open gates, the horsemen left the town, Aeneas at their head, line 795, Achates at his right hand, then the others, Trojan offers, and Pallas himself. King Evantine's son, mid-column in short cloak with blazoned arms, a sight as brilliant as the morning star, whom Venus loves above all stellar fires, when from the bath of ocean into heaven he lifts his holy visage, making night dissolve and wane. Mothers with quaking breasts were standing on the walls, watching the cloud of dust, the burnished gleams of Calvary, as the armed riders picked their way through scrub cross-country toward their goal. A shout went up, and forming into column, they rode on, hoofbeat of horses shaking the dust of the plain. Near the cold stream of Sierre there's a grove, immense and deep, awesome to our forebears. The hills encircle it with dark fir trees. The tale goes that old Pelasgians, who held this Latin country who knows when, made grove and feast day sacred to Sylvanus, god of the fields and herds. Not far from here, Tarchon and his Tyrrhenians had encamped on favorable ground, and one could see from a high hill the tents of all the enemy on the wide plain. Now Lord Aeneas came to this place, with his soldiers picked for battle. Here they refreshed their weariness and gave their horses pasture. Venus, the gleaming goddess, bearing her gifts, came down among high clouds, and far away still, in a vale apart, sighted her son beside the ice-cold stream. Then making her appearance as she willed, she said to him, "Here are the gifts I promised, Aeneas, forging to perfection by my husband's craft, so that you need not hesitate to challenge arrogant Laurentines or savage Turnus, however soon in battle." As she spoke, Cytherea swept to her son's embrace and placed the shining arms before his eyes under an oak tree. Now the man in joy at a goddess's gifts, at being so greatly honored, could not be satisfied, but scanned each piece in wonder and turned over in his hands the helmet with its terrifying plumes and gushing flames, the sword blade edged with fate, the cuirass of hard bronze, red blood and huge, like a dark cloud burning with sunset light that sends a glow for miles. So how did it shine? Like a cloud burning with sunset light that sends a glow for miles, the polished greaves of gold and silver alloy, the great spear, and finally the fabric of the shield, beyond description. And what is on his shield? Remember how Achilles' shield told all of this history? Well, this shield also has history. There the Lord of Fire, knowing the prophets, knowing the age to come, had wrought the future story of Italy. So Hephaestus put the whole future story of Italy on this shield. The triumphs of the Romans. There one found the generations of Ascanius's heirs, the wars they fought, each one. Vulcan had made the mother wolf lying in Mars' green grotto, so the grotto of the she-wolf. The Lupercal, lying in Mars' green grotto, made the twin boys at play about her teats, nursing the mother without fear, while she bent round her smooth neck, fondling them in turn, and shaping their bodies with her tongue. Nearby, Rome had been added by the artisan, and Saban women roughly carried off, that's the rape of the Saban women, carried off out of the audience of the circus games. Then suddenly a new war coming on to pit the sons of Romulus against old Tatius and his austere town of Cures. Later, the same king's warfare laid aside in arms before Jove's altar stood and held libation dishes as they made a pact with offering of swine. Not far from this, two four-horse war cars whipped on back to back had torn Metis apart. Still, man of Alba, you should have kept your word. That's why he was ripped apart, apparently. And Roman Tullus dragged the liar's rags of flesh away through woods where brambles dripped a bloody dew. There, too, Porsena stood, ordering Rome to take the exiled Tarchon back, then bringing the whole city under massive siege. There for their liberty, Aeneas sons threw themselves forward on the enemy's spears. You might have seen Porsena imaged there, to the life a menacing man, a man in anger at Roman daring. Cocles, who downed the bridge. Chloea, who broke her bonds and swam the river. On the shield's upper quarter, Manlius, guard of the Tarpeian Rock. Which is a cool story. It might be in your glossary. The Tarpeian Rock is a cool story. Stood fast before the temple and held the capital, where Romulus's house was newly thatched and rough. Here, fluttering through gilded porticos at night, the silvery goose warned of the Gauls approaching. Under cover of the darkness, Gauls amid the bushes had crept near, and now lay hold upon the citadel. Golden locks they had and golden dress. These are French guys. Gaul eventually is called France. Glimmering with striped cloaks, their milky necks entwined with gold, they hefted alpine spears, two each, and had long body shields for cover. Vulcan had fashioned naked Luperci and Celaei, leaping there with woolen caps and fallen from heaven shields, and put chaste ladies riding in cushioned carriages through Rome with sacred images. At a distance then he pictured the deep hell of Tartarus, Dis's high gate, crime's punishments, and yes, you, Catiline, on a precarious cliff, hanging and trembling at the fury's glare. Then far away from this were virtual souls, and Cato giving laws to them. Mid shield the picture, sea flowing surge, all of gold, as white caps formed on the blue waters, and dolphins shining in silver round and round the scene, propelled themselves with flukes and cut through billows. Vivid in the center were the bronze beaked ships. Remember, this is all still part of the shield. We're now to the center part. And this is going to be the Battle of Actium, which was in 31 BC, which is where Cleopatra gave up, and then Antony is going to commit suicide. Vivid in the center were the bronze beaked ships and the Phi at sea off Actium. Here you could see Leucata all alive with ships maneuvering, sea glowing gold, Augustus Caesar leading into battle, Italians with both senators and people, household gods and great gods. So now Virgil is to the point on the shield where it's actually describing the history that they are living in right now when this is written. There he stood high on the stern, and from his blessed brow twin flames gushed upward while his crest revealed his father's star. Apart from him, Agrippa, this is Herod Agrippa, favored by winds and gods, led ships in column, a towering figure, wearing on his brows the coronet, adorned with warships' beaks, highest distinction for command at sea. Then came Antonius with barbarous wealth and a diversity of arms, victorious from races in the Donlands and the Red Sea, leading the power of East, of Egypt, even of distant Bactra on the steppes. That's talking about Antony and Cleopatra, Antonius. And in his wake, the Egyptian consort, that's Cleopatra, came so shamefully. The ships all kept together, racing ahead, the water torn by oar strokes, torn by the triple beaks in spume and foam, all made for the open sea. You might believe the Cyclades uprooted were afloat, or mountains running against mountain heights, when seamen in those hulks pressed the attack upon the other turreted ships. They hurled broadsides of burning flax on flying steel, and fresh blood reddened Neptune's fields. The queen amidst the battle called her flotilla on with a sistrum's beat of frenzy out of Egypt. And of course this is Poseidon's fields or Neptune's fields, so a lot of blood on the sea in this battle. Never turning her head as yet to see twin snakes of death behind, while monster forms of gods of every race and the dog god Anubis barking held their weapons up against our Neptune, Venus, and Minerva. Athena, Mars, engraved in steel, raged in the fight as from high air the dire furies came with discord, taking joy in a torn robe and on their heels with bloody scourge, Bellona. Overlooking it all, Actian Apollo began to pull his bow. Wild at this sight, all Egyptians, Indians, Arabians, all Sabaeans, put about in flight, and she, the queen, appeared crying for winds to shift, just as she hauled up sail and slackened sheets. The Lord of Fire had portrayed her there, so Hephi even put Cleopatra on the shield. Amid the slaughter, pallid with death to come, then borne by waves and wind from the northwest, while the great length of mourning Nile awaited her with open bays, calling the conquered home to his blue bosom and his hideous hidden streams. But Caesar then in triple triumph rode within the walls of Rome, making immortal offerings to the gods of Italy. 300 princely shrines throughout the city. There were the streets humming with festal joy and games and cheers, an altar to every shrine, to every one a mother's choir, and bullocks knifed before the altar strewed the ground. The man himself, enthroned before the snow-white threshold of sunny Phoebus, Apollo, viewed the gifts the nations of the earth made, and he fitted them to the tall portals. Conquered races passed in long procession, varied in languages as in their dress and arms. So this is Caesar parading his trophies through the forum, having a special parade. Varied in language. Here, Mulciber, remember Mulciber? Divine smith, it's Hephi, had portrayed the nomad, same as Vulcan, the nomad tribes and Afri with ungirdled flowing robes. Here, Ligulus and Carians, and here, Gelogians with... Gelogians with quivers. Here Euphrates, milder in his flood now. There Morini, northernmost of men. Here bull-horned Rhine, and there the still unconquered Scythian Dahae. Here, vexed at being bridged, the rough Araxes. So these are river gods. All these images on Vulcan's shield, his mother's gift, were wonders to Aeneas. Knowing nothing of the events themselves, he felt joy in their pictures. Because remember, Aeneas doesn't know what any of this means. Because he's living 1000 BC, Virgil's telling the story. story about 20 B.C., so Aeneas looks at this, their wonders to him. Knowing nothing of the events themselves, he felt joy in their pictures, taking up upon his shoulder all the destined acts and fame of his descendants.